Okay, let's jump into hour number three. Had enough tonight? Yeah, we got another hour to go, so sit down and hold on. This is going to be very, very informative. This hour is Jeff and Erica, and we produce these hours to try to get the best information, the most information that we can assemble in the hour for all of you to get, so you'll not be led astray. The first casualty in war is the truth. The first casualty in the truth, in terms of media, is also the truth. You've got so many green screeners out there, so many never was and never will be types, playing doctor, playing scientist, playing this and that. Then you've got some real scientists who just don't understand up from down. They're probably flat earthers, some of them. I don't know. But I've seen some grim and dismal information. And we don't play games here. I just tell it like I see it. First, let me welcome Erica back, my partner here. She does a tremendous amount of work for all of us. Welcome back, Erica.
Well, good evening, Jeff. Thank you. Good to be back.
You're welcome. Yeah. We have an issue. It's a problem. Flat Earth, okay. You can chuckle at Flat Earth. And I will admit that they have some very interesting articles. They have some very interesting arguments. But it just doesn't work if you really study the situation objectively and use your head. It's pretty simple. So we have another issue now. And it's in the realm of medical science or biological science. And it's this group of people who are beginning to push, and it's gaining traction, the idea that there is no such a critter as a virus. There are no viruses. And I just don't know where to begin with this thing. So what I did was invite some of these anti-virus people to come over, and at least in a virtual sense, they can watch in, and they're kind of gathered together in a group. Let me see if they're there. Are you guys there? All right. Now, you just as long as you stay quiet, you can remain and listen. I want you to hear this because I think it might help some of you who are sitting on the fence. Now, leading the charge, to a large degree, is a doctor, he's a psychiatrist, Dr. Andy Kaufman. And I have nothing against Andy. I think he's probably a great guy. But he's just wrong. And has he studied virology? Has he studied hard science virus research? Here's what he had to say.
You know, I've never done virus research.
You want to follow that guy into infinity? Good luck. I would rather have someone like the two doctors we're going to hear from shortly who have studied virology and serious science. So you folks in the peanut gallery, just be quiet over there. And we're going to... I'm sorry, I just couldn't resist.
Well, you do have to laugh at some of this stuff. It is absurd. It really is. It's like we're going backwards in time.
If we don't laugh, we're lost. And my God, in this day and age, as bad as things are, you got to laugh. And I hope they laugh at us. Whatever makes them happy. I couldn't care less. Not a possible way. All right. You want to introduce our first short video with Dr. Peter McCullough? He's got about a minute and a half or so here of something he wants to tell us.
Yeah, he, as you know, he gives quite a few interviews, very, very public figure these days. And recently he was speaking on the topic of how long the spike protein production might last in somebody who has received these injections. And he finally has come out and said that it's not the 1 week or couple weeks that they initially told us. I don't even think it was that. I think it was a matter of days initially. And at least in his estimation, it may be up to a year depending on how many boosters you get.
Or how successful it is in changing your DNA in your cells, et cetera. I mean, this is a big question. Now, I don't want to speak for Erica, but in my view, after watching this horror show for 2+ years now, my position would be that in many cases, now remember, in every mRNA injection, the word is there are 500 trillion little mRNA packets that go into your body, get into a cell, I'll keep it simple, with the lipid nanoparticles, and they set up shop in order the cell to begin to produce spike proteins. Now, I submit that a lot of people are going to be stuck with this for the rest of their lives, which will not be as long as they very well might have been. How do you see it personally?
I think that's a good possibility. I mean, initially, and Peter McCullough had said this, that the reason this type of platform, gene delivery platform, had failed for gene therapies, meaning they were trying to introduce into the body proteins that were lacking because of a genetic defect, so they could hopefully transfect cells, possibly most likely in the liver, to produce the protein that was missing, and then they would have a cure for this unfortunate person that was born deficient. But the problem was they couldn't get the protein to continuously be produced. So a matter of weeks or months would go by, and the person would need another injection. And at a certain point, it became toxic. I mean, this type of delivery, particularly with the lipid nanoparticles, was too toxic. And they never really tweaked it well enough with the adenovirus to not induce this type of multi-system organ failure, highly inflammatory reaction. So it fell by the wayside, and then they tried to resurrect it as a quote-unquote vaccine for infectious diseases. And somehow with this one, they've managed to ensure that the protein production goes on indefinitely, it appears, something they weren't able to do with their gene therapy target. So I don't know. Is there something in the code that is allowing for this or causing this? Looks like it.
We need to remember the words of Dr. Chetty, that the spike protein is the most, I'm paraphrasing, the most evil, deadly thing that humankind has ever created. It is working in your body, not just in your extremities. Don't think fingers and arms and elbows. Think your major organ systems. Think head to toe, from brain to your big toe. It doesn't matter. You are full of spike proteins that your body has manufactured. And among many things, the spike protein causes microvascular clotting. Microclotting. And if you start with a little one here, add another one there, you shut down a few capillaries, the cells that were fed by the blood that went through those capillaries die, you've got a problem. Because these are going to build up into bigger and bigger clots. That's what they are. They're clots. We don't know how big. We don't know how long. But we do know that everybody who has taken those shots is developing serious trouble via microclotting. That's just one aspect of it. And if, in fact, they are produced by a vaxxed body permanently, I think you can all understand, and we've tried not to belabor the point, but the lives of those people are going to be shortened in most cases, unless there's some kind of a miraculous turnaround. All right, we've got a video here that Erica told you about, so we'll run this. It's only a minute, a little over a minute long. This is Dr. Peter McCullough. Okay, here we go.
The autopsy study started to come in this fall, Patrick, of people who had taken the vaccine and then underwent autopsies, and we could see the fingerprint of the vaccines everywhere in the body, in the brain, the heart, the bone marrow. In a paper by Holtgen and colleagues, published just a few months ago in the preprint service system, the messenger RNA itself stays in the human body for months. It was found in lymph tissues and subcuticular tissues. I published papers with Tony Karagoglis from Athens, Greece, mm-hmm. showing that the nucleoside analog caps ought to make that messenger RNA resistant. And now Bruce Patterson from Incell DX, and I've had him on the McCullough Report, and he's published in the preprint server, that the spike protein in the human body, we estimate after vaccination, stays in the human body, Patrick, probably for over a year. So shot one, over a year. Shot two, over a year. Boosters every 6 months. The body is being loaded with a foreign pathogenic protein, and it's in all the vital organs.
Well, I hope you all understood that. He made it very clear in his opinion now. He's extending it out to a year. That's assuming that people live that long. A lot of them don't, unfortunately. But again, we feel there's no reason at this point, because we don't know, to really draw any kind of an outside boundary on when the spike protein will stop being manufactured by your body if you happen to be injected. And I want to also say that you're all welcome to this program, vaxxed or otherwise. We want to help all people understand this, because the more knowledge you can gain, the better chance you have to live a longer life. And that's for both vaxxed and unvaxxed people. Because the vaxxed people are being exposed, obviously, to one or more things from, well, did I say the unvaxxed? The unvaxxed are being exposed by the vaxxed to more than one thing, at least the spike protein. And you've got to keep that in mind. When you're out and about, you know, the mask mandate is dropped and all of that. You're around people. You don't know their vax status. And if you understand that shedding is quite real, you might want to consider wearing a mask. I do. Maybe it's only worth 5%, but I'll take that. I'll take that. It's a real serious issue out there. And I guess the issue of vaxxed drivers is also getting worse. How are you seeing it?
Yeah, I am noticing it more. There does seem to be more people driving that seem confused, dazed, not quite like they're drunk, but just driving very, very slow and just having trouble deciding where they want to go. I mean, you know, that happens anyway, but now I'm just seeing a lot of it, more so than I ever have.
Do they pull off the road? What do they do? They're just
drive
acting
real
in, acting incompetently.
Yeah, and then other times I just see them, hesitating at an intersection and pulling out when there's an oncoming car. I've seen that a lot.
Well,
I mean, that could
noted.
Be anything, but I'm noticing more of that than I ever have.
This has been noted for, the better part of a year? I guess people aren't driving right. And the other side of the automobile coin is that I saw it again today. There are far fewer cars on the road. Maybe half.
Yep.
I don't know if your town's that way, but there are fewer cars. There's just people are not going out, or they're too sick to go out. I don't know.
Yeah, I certainly the gas prices going up is probably going to exacerbate that. It's going to be very diminished activity here shortly, I think.
Well, we're going to see real soon $10 a gallon gasoline, no doubt. All right. Now, we have a very interesting video. It's one of our patented video interviews with someone who is on video. So we're going to play this, and we'll stop and try and enhance it a little bit here and there. But this is a video featuring Dr. Richard Fleming, who is, in my opinion, second. I don't want to put anybody down. So there's nobody better right now than Dr. Richard Fleming at explaining the viral issue that we're all facing. So we're going to play some of this for you. You got an intro that you want to add here?
Yeah, I'll just say that he is one of the few, I think, American MDs that's willing to call a spade a spade insofar as what this injection is.
Right, right. Okay. All right, here we go. Dr. Richard Fleming, who is not a big favorite of some people. They don't like him. I don't know exactly what the reasoning is, but he has been rather criticized in the past by some, but I don't find anything wrong with what the man is saying at all.
And, no, he's very thorough,
No. Are you people... No. I know. They don't like Dr. Fleming. All right, come on, you guys. Quiet down over there. All right, here's Dr. Richard Fleming. Here we go.
Dr. Fleming, we've asked you to come testify about whether COVID-19 and related vaccines are a deliberate bioweapon attack on the United States. Madam Court Reporter, can you please identify yourself for the record?
My name is Karen Usher, Texas CSR number 5536.
Thank you. Can you please swear in the witness?
Dr. Fleming, will you raise your right hand? Do you swear the testimony you give today will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Dr. Fleming, do you consent to this testimony being used in any appropriate proceeding?
Yes, I do.
All right, here we go.
First, I'd like to cover some of your qualifications. You have a impressive 90-page resume. I'm not going to go through that, but very briefly, are you a medical doctor?
Yes, I am.
So therefore, you have an MD degree, as it's known.
I do, yes.
And what is your area of specialty?
Nuclear cardiology, cardiology, and internal medicine.
And you also belong to professional medical associations?
Yes, I do.
Are you a fellow of the American College of Physicians?
Yes.
And are you a fellow of the American Society of Internal Medicine?
Yes.
And you also hold a PhD?
Yes, I do.
And in what field?
Physics.
And you also have a law degree, otherwise known as a JD?
I do.
And are you an inventor in the medical field?
Yes.
And very briefly, can you explain the type of medical inventions that you've invented?
The ability to image the body and determine what types of disease processes are going on by looking at metabolism and blood flow.
And do you hold patents for your inventions?
Yes, I do.
Is it fair to say you're familiar with the world of medical patents?
Yes.
You have the ability to read and interpret medical patents?
Yes, I do.
And are you also an author of professional papers?
Yes, sir.
And approximately how many?
Somewhere between 400 and 500.
And do you also serve on the editorial board of professional journals?
On editorial boards and review boards for the journals.
And briefly, what does a reviewer in a professional journal do?
The obligation is when somebody submits a paper for publication for reviewers to take a look at that material to determine if it's scientifically valid, to determine if it makes a difference in the field, and to make recommendations back to the editorial board about whether the paper should be accepted or revised or rejected for publication.
Part one. Is COVID-19 a bioweapon?
Are you prepared to testify under oath here today that COVID-19 is a bioweapon?
Yes, I am.
You wrote a book posing the question, is COVID-19 a bioweapon? Correct?
Correct. The function of the book was to provide information that the general public could look at and also to provide evidence for the legal system and the medical system to understand the gain-of-function research that's been carried out over a couple decades, to show where the monies came from, to show what papers were published showing what types of gain-of-function research occurred, and to show the patents, to clearly lay out 2 decades worth of work that's been conducted, funded primarily by the United States, although other countries have been involved, and to show how there's no evidence that SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, no evidence to show that it's naturally occurring, no animal model for it, and to show the type of research that's been done with coronaviruses funded by the U.S., supported by NIAID, NIH, Department of Defense, monies that went to Peter Daszak at EcoHealth, to Ralph Burrick at the University of North Carolina, to Qixing Li at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and to several other universities around the country, including in the state of Texas.
Did you also look at the genetic code of the SARS-CoV-2 virus and especially the spike protein?
We did, as well as Professor Luc Montagnier, who is the gentleman who discovered the HIV virus, and several other individuals that we note in the book.
And based on that review of the genetic code, that informed your conclusion that this is a bioweapon.
Right. So the Biological Weapons Convention Treaty states that any adjustment or modification of a biological agent like this virus that doesn't provide a benefit for mankind is a biological weapon. These particular changes in this virus, including the PRRA insert, which are amino acids that were inserted that are very critical for the purine cleavage site for this virus to infect, the insertion sites that were made with HIV and simian or ape-like HIV equivalent viruses, the prion-like domain at the top of the spike protein, as well as the HIV glycoprotein 120 insert that Qixing Li put in early on that's critical for the attachment of this virus to cells, all of which are not naturally occurring.
So to be clear, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, otherwise known as COVID-19, and especially its spike protein, is not something that's simply involved on its own in nature.
We've looked at all the different coronaviruses that exist on the planet. None of them have the PRRA insert. None of them have this tremendous amount of HIV insert. None of them have a regional binding domain that is a prion-like binding domain, which means that where it attaches to the cells, it's a prion-like domain, and prions are things that are abnormal proteins that cause other proteins to become abnormally folded.
So to be clear, genetic changes were made to the spike protein in a lab to create what is known as the COVID-19, correct?
That's what all the data shows.
Your book references research in 2010 by Qixing Li, who's often called the Bat Lady. Was that research designed to determine how to increase the spike protein binding capacity to the human ACE2 receptor?
So that was her goal of that research, was to increase the ability of the virus to infect human cells.
Now, interestingly, I think in this published research, they discovered that the naturally occurring spike protein from horseshoe bats was unable to bind to the human ACE2 receptors.
Right, that's exactly right.
So as of 2010, scientists, including Qixing Li in Wuhan, China, knew that naturally occurring horseshoe bat coronavirus spike proteins could not infect humans.
That's right.
Based on your testimony, it sounds like you discovered at least two man-made inserts into the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein genetic code that prove it was produced in a lab.
Right. The research papers that Qixing Li and Burrick and others published, they were very clear and somewhat proud of the fact that they'd been able to modify the virus and to insert changes into it that made it more infective and potentially more dangerous.
Is there some?
But Erica, there are no such things as viruses.
Right.
What is wrong with these people?
I have to think it's a campaign to keep a certain portion of the population in a state of stupid. Seriously.
Not a hard job to do when you own the media, when
Correct.
People really don't understand what they're listening to, what they're looking at, and they don't understand the process of interaction with a flat screen. It has nothing to do with two-way thought and communication, except on an extremely superficial level. It's essentially a reactive process, not proactive. So it's not hard to understand how billions of people can be controlled very easily. Not in my world. It looks like a piece of cake to me.
Yep.
Okay. Now that's Dr. Richard Fleming. His position in this has really never changed from the beginning. He has received a lot of abuse, as have other doctors who have stood up and tried to tell the truth. This is going to be very interesting. Ready to go on to the next portion?
Yep.
Okay, here we go. Dr. Richard Fleming.
that was put forward and actually published in The Lancet was that this was a naturally occurring virus with an animal host that got transmitted to people, but yet there's not been a single animal model found with this. Neither has there been a single coronavirus that has this PRA insert.
You mentioned the second insert, an HIV glycoprotein.
Right.
So are you saying that sections of the genetic code for HIV were inserted into the SARS-CoV-2 virus?
Yeah, Xi Zeng Li published this early on many years ago, where she was very proud of the fact that she did this. She used an HIV pseudovirus to do it. And we also know that HIV glycoprotein 120 is a prion.
So this is the HIV that became famous in the 80s and 90s. It's that HIV.
Right.
And somebody took pieces of the genetic code of HIV and put it into SARS-CoV-2?
Very important. Pieces of the genetic code. They did not put the whole virus in there, and you are not going to get HIV. You may have pieces of HIV from the vax that will trigger a false positive in a home do-it-yourself HIV test kit, which we think is where this whole thing is going. Correct?
That's correct. Interestingly, some of these viral pieces, and this goes for any virus, when the virus breaks down and the body's trying to get rid of it, some of this viral fragments can have adverse effects on the body. They can be immune suppressive. And I'm wondering if those are the ones that they chose from the GP120 glycoprotein on HIV to attach to the spike protein in this SARS-CoV-2 virus.
He also
mentioned not the entire, you know, HIV GP120 protein. It's just little fragments of it, but they could be biologically active all by themselves. They
sure
can induce some kind of reason. And Richard Fleming is claiming that portions of the GP120 act like a prion, much the same as the spike protein does in the SARS virus.
Prions, for those of you who may be new to the program or new to the subject, harken back to what they were calling BSE, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or TSE, transmissible spongiform encephalopathy, brain destroyers, okay? There's also VCJD and NVCJD. There are a number of different tags they've put on this, but basically prions will kill you. They'll destroy
yeah
your brain. It's a one-way ticket out of here. And let's pick up the rest of this short clip here with Dr. Richard Fleming.
Which Xi Zeng Li admitted to in publications that she had, yes.
Were you able to discover why that was done?
According to papers that she published, it was to increase the infectivity to see if she could make it more infective. But it's even clearer that what she was going for was the development of a prion disease, because where everybody is kind of coming up to speed with a virus and how challenging it can be to deal with, what's even more challenging to deal with are prions, because prion diseases are relatively new in our understanding for treatment, and they cause permanent damage unless they can be reversed. And so the development of a prion, putting HIV glycoprotein 120 in there, attaching to the sialic acid receptor, there's nothing about that that is advantageous for people. And the ability to produce prion diseases is quite a weapon.
Quite a weapon indeed, as in a pandemic of brain death. It can go anywhere. What do we know about the transmissibility of prions that we can just quickly pop out here?
Well, there's prion disease that arises spontaneously within the body, and how that happens is not quite understood. Some people do seem to have a genetic predisposition to it. But then there's other forms that are transmissible, and you can acquire them from tainted meat. But they're also airborne, and as we know from CWD, chronic wasting disease, and the cervids, these goats, moose, deer, they shed this stuff from their skin, antlers, whatever, into the ground, and then the plants can uptake this material, these prions, and then when the next deer, sheep, goat comes along and eats that plant, they can acquire the prion and have the disease.
Remember, they've given a lot of different names to this mad cow disease. TSE, BSE, as I've said, VCJD, CJD. In deer, they decided to give it another little cutesy name, chronic wasting disease.
Yep.
And it's mad cow. And it primarily got into the deer populace, which I believe is now, I think you can find evidence of CWD in about 30 states. And the deer got it by going into the fields with the cattle and eating cattle feed. Because they put in the cattle feed the brains of other species of animals. Huh?
Yep.
It's really simple. I remember this story about the elk farmer in Canada, and for those of you who have heard this before, forgive me. He had a big business selling the velvet from the antlers of his, well, they were called reindeer at one point, elk. And he came down with two or three animals that had mad cow. And the Canadian government went out and said, well, I'm sorry, you're going to have to put your herd down. He said, what am I going to do? And he had, you know, hundreds of acres, maybe thousands, I don't know. And he said, well, I'll just go into agriculture and I'll raise crops. And they said, no, you won't. This farm is now forever condemned because prions are in the soil and therefore they are in the grasses and the other fodder that the animals eat and can be transmitted that way. So this farm is quarantined permanently. And that was the
end of
that.
Yeah, that's the insidious thing about the prion protein is it's indestructible. It can survive in environmental conditions. I think, I forget what temperature is required to...
1,100 degrees.
Yeah, it's super, super hot. So the average flame is not going to...
No.
Not going to destroy it.
A crematory is 650 degrees approximately. And the prions from someone who died of mad cow disease, no matter what they call it, Alzheimer's, dementia, the prions go right up the smokestack, the chimney, and out over the surrounding neighborhood. That's a fact.
Yeah. Yep.
So, because they can withstand well over 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. It's really crazy. All right, we're going to go back to... Dr. Richard Fleming, I don't think our guests are impressed with. Let's see what do you people say? Huh? Well, all right, that's enough. Please be quiet. They don't like Dr. Fleming because Dr. Fleming is a virologist. He's an expert in the field, and these people don't like viruses. They don't think they exist. It's just, I respect their rights to their own opinion. We have a First Amendment still, somewhere. All right, back to Dr. Fleming here. Some more very interesting material.
If you look at the emergency use authorization documents, the document submitted to the FDA, you have to ask yourself two questions. And the data is right in the EUA documents. The first question is, how many people get sick? And that's this number that we talk about, vaccine efficacy. How many people get sick if they're vaccinated versus how many people get sick if they weren't vaccinated? So that's this vaccine efficacy number. But if you ask the question, why are people getting vaccinated? That's not why they're getting vaccinated. They're getting vaccinated so they don't get sick. And that's called an absolute risk reduction. And if you go to the EUA documents for Pfizer, Moderna, Janssen, the three that are EUA approved in the U.S., and you ask that fundamental question, how many people do not get sick for Pfizer, that using their data, there's no statistically significant reduction in COVID cases for vaccinated people versus unvaccinated. If you look at Moderna, the same thing. No statistical reduction in COVID cases for the vaccinated versus the unvaccinated. Janssen did a little bit more complex. They looked at results at 2 weeks, 14 days after their injection, and 28 days or 4 weeks. Now, if you look at their data at 2 weeks after the injection, there is a statistical reduction in the number of COVID cases. If you carry that out 2 more weeks, which they did, that difference is gone. There's no, so if you want to vaccinate people, I guess every 2 weeks, go for it. It doesn't prevent you from getting infected. Statistically, it didn't reduce the number of COVID cases or deaths, and it doesn't prevent you from transmitting it. And that's what we're seeing right now. No virus comes in just one flavor, if you will. Just like if you look around a room, you'll see a whole bunch of people and they're all variants, but they're all very much human, right? So SARS-CoV-2 didn't just come as Wuhan HE1. It had the alpha and the beta and the gamma and the lambda and the delta and all the other variants, all the different changes. And what we've done in the past is we've taken and made vaccines by taking all of the parts of a virus with all of the variants and weakening it and then injecting that into people so that if you saw another version of it or other parts of it, you would have an immune response to it. What we did with these vaccines is we very specifically said, let's just look at the spike protein of the original one, the one called Wuhan HE1, and let's make that genetic code and turn the human cells into a manufacturing plant to make those spike proteins. Well, what did that do? For the people who got vaccinated, many of them who did it because they were worried about other people. So understanding that these people were well-intentioned. They were afraid. They were fearful. They didn't want somebody else to get sick because of them. They didn't want other family members to become sick. They didn't want the man or the woman down the street who had cancer or heart disease to become sick. So as good citizens, they were told, you need to do this, and it will make a difference. But the vaccines don't prevent you from getting infected or spreading it. So by using this approach, we injected this mRNA and DNA into people for just one type of spike protein, not the rest of the virus, not the nuclear capsid, which turns out to be what humans make the best immune response to, not the envelope, not the membrane, and not the other types of spike protein. One type. And so what we see is people getting vaccinated with it. And if you track what's happened, not only in the United States, but around the world, as these vaccines have been used, fewer and fewer people have gotten infected with the Wuhan HU1, or if they've gotten infected, they were ready for it, but they weren't ready for the other variants, the alpha, the beta, the gamma, the delta, the mu, the now Omicron, as people like to call it, what I call 21K, but Omicron is now the term for it. Those, they didn't have an immune response to. So they responded to it rapidly, and then when they spread the virus to other people, they spread the ones that weren't attacked because the immune system wasn't ready for it. So we've done a great job of pressure selecting out this virus to the variants so that we're spreading and shifting it. And now the spike protein of Omicron is so much different than even Delta or Alpha or HE1 that the ability of our immune system to respond to that isn't there. And we're seeing more and more people with this variant coming down with symptoms and spreading it to other people.
Now, he keeps talking about viruses, Erica, as if viruses are a real thing. It's quite a remarkable performance here. I think what he's doing here is extremely valuable. This is one of the most articulate presentations I've seen. Of course, I think the Academy Award should go to Dr. Chetty, who in a minute and 35 seconds summed it all up. I won't play that again. I've played it many times on the program. It is, without question, this spike protein, the most deadly, evil thing mankind has ever created. All right, any comments on what we just heard with Dr. Fleming?
Yeah, he's absolutely right. The vaccine would never prevented infection. It never prevented transmission. So these people were duped into taking something for nothing that is likely going to have adverse consequences indefinitely. That's pretty sad. And I, as far as this Omicron thing goes, I'm not so sure it's a legitimate mutation as opposed to something that was intentionally released. I mean, there's 60 mutations in it and 32 in the spike protein. I mean, that's a lot.
Now that's what we know about already, and there are certainly potentially more. We don't know.
In addition to a couple insertions and deletions that, you know, if this was naturally evolved, nah, I'm not buying it. So I do think that they are still releasing stuff on us, putting things into these vaccines, and seeding additional infections in the population.
Okay, let's go back to Dr. Richard Fleming here and see what he has to say next. He's got a lot to say, and I just think he's quite articulate, put it mildly. You people, I told you, you've got to be quiet. Stop. They do not like viruses. I invited you over here. Behave yourselves. Yeah, we'll see. All right, let's go back to Dr. Fleming. I turned the mic down. I trusted them. Okay, here we go.
Body through these so-called vaccines functionally different than the introduction of those spike proteins through the SARS-CoV-2 virus.
When people spread infections back and forth, they spread hundreds or thousands or, you know, if you want to be generous, 10,000 virus particles by coughing or sneezing on somebody. And so that's the amount that you would get exposed to. And that's why, you know, back in 2020, we saw so many people with the comorbidities because they already had diseases where there was inflammation and blood clotting going on. With the vaccines, those numbers are significantly different. We're not talking about thousands or tens of thousands. We're talking about billions in these vaccines. And
billions of spike proteins?
Billions of genetic sequences to make spike proteins. For Pfizer and Moderna, it's 13.1 billion. For Janssen and AstraZeneca, it's 50 billion. And the other thing is that a virus to get into your cell has to find, you know, that ACE2 receptor that we talked about. These vaccines don't. The lipid nanoparticles simply merge with your cell membrane. They don't have to look for an ACE2 receptor to get in. They simply merge with it and release all that genetic sequence in. What we're seeing with vaccinated individuals are healthy people reacting. Why? Because they're not getting exposed to 1,000 or 10,000 virus particles from somebody else who coughed or sneezed on them, which shouldn't have coughed or sneezed on them, right? They're getting billions. And if they have a functioning, healthy body, their immune system is looking at that and saying, wow, we have just been massively infected, and they mount an immune response. And that immune response has inflammation and blood clotting. You release chemicals to kill the cells that are infected. That's why you get a runny nose. That's that fluid being released. And blood clotting to wall off the invader so that it can't get out, number one, and number two, can't get nutrients in, so it dies. So that inflammation and blood clotting is what your body should do, except you don't get infected with billions of these viruses. So healthy people are reacting to something that looks like a nuclear bomb went off in their body, and they're reacting to it, producing a lot of inflammation, a lot of blood clotting, and a lot of very adverse events. And what we're seeing with all the people...
Okay. He's going to finish here. Let me let him finish. He's got one more point.
Adverse events are all the people that are healthy, younger, responding to what appears to be an overwhelming infection in their body with all the spike proteins, and we're seeing inflammation and blood clotting, and you've seen it with strokes and seizures and heart disease and, you know, miscarriages and deaths that we've never seen before in the history of mankind for vaccines that have been made.
Never seen before in the history of mankind. There we are again. How can the truth of this issue not be, I mean, if I would expect to see more doctors standing up with a bullhorn talking about this stuff like Dr. Chetty did, but they're not. Now, Richard Fleming in this video is probably the most thorough and succinct presentation, talking about all of these viruses, all the virus research that's gone on, how the viruses are manipulated, how they're tweaked. And he did also mention the reporting system, which is a big issue, VAERS. So let's see what he has to say about that. It's just a little short clip here. All right.
Animal research for many decades of my life, and there's a reason for doing it. It's because you don't experiment on people unless you're Nazis.
And if I understand it correctly, the CDC VAERS reporting system is showing more deaths and injuries from COVID-19 vaccines than all other vaccines combined for the last 30 years.
It is. And you know, independent upon whether you believe those numbers or not, and you think they're 1% or 10%, whether you should put 10 or 20 behind the numbers, here's some interesting things about this reporting system. As a physician, I've tried to call in to the VAERS reporting system, and I get a recording that gives me another telephone number to go to. When I call that number, it gives me a recording and no place to leave a message. I have colleagues who have tried to enter it in on the computer system, and it keeps bouncing back. Now, if you come into a hospital or doctor's office and you have an adverse event to measles, mumps, and rubella vaccines, there's a code to enter into that, and it goes into the computer. If you have an adverse event to diphtheria and tetanus vaccine, there's a code for that that goes into the computer, and that will be tracked through history. These things are called computerized procedural terminology, CPT codes. There is no CPT code to enter into a computer system for an adverse event to any of these SARS-CoV-2 vaccines.
Even though this is part of a clinical trial, and therefore they have a legal obligation to track adverse events, there is no universal code for physicians to code in an adverse event?
That's right.
Have you ever?
That's right. There's nothing. So we've all heard about VAERS, and if you look at the VAERS statistics, VAERS admitted in the beginning they only got 1% reported, correct?
Yeah, that was the conclusion of a study that was done by Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare. And the inclusive dates of the study that they looked at was, I think it was 2007 to 2010, so about 2.5 years. They just looked at what was being reported, how often, and they analyzed how many adverse events are actually reported to the CDC. And it came out at a shocking 1%. Now, many doctors, physicians, clinicians are not familiar that there even exists this type of reporting system. And as you can see, the ones that do encounter difficulties in filing reports. So they've made it inordinately difficult.
What a coincidence.
How convenient.
Well, all right. I hope all of this has been helpful to all of you. I want to thank our invited guests. And I know they don't agree with us, but just to show that we are an open door here and we do believe in the First Amendment, I did invite them over and see if they... I've turned their mic down. Let's see what they're saying over there. Yeah. They're not. There they go. There they go. All right. Good night. Good night. Okay. It's always good to get both sides of an issue. That's journalism. And look, there are viruses, dear friends. And if you don't want to believe in them, I support you 100%. That's fine. But listen to the people like this gentleman we just heard from. They just don't become any more articulate than Dr. Richard Fleming. He's right up there. And people have taken shots at him. Oh, don't think they haven't. So, at any rate, what did you think of his presentation?
Oh, I thought it was excellent. It's worth watching. I think this thing is about 54 minutes in its entirety.
Yeah.
It's, but he covers a lot, and it's well worth listening to.
I'll have it up in headlines. It'll be under guests already. I think it, in fact, is in guests. It should be. If it isn't, it'll be there. Dr. Richard Flynn.
And hopefully it inspires more medical professionals to take a stand, come forward.
I would like that. I wish they would all take a lesson from Dr. Chetty.
Yep.
He's summed it right up. Okay, thanks, Erica, very much. I think we, again, hopefully help some people out there understand the morass that we're in. Yeah, that's what we're trying. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Jeff. Have a good evening.
Okay, thanks. All right, that's it for Friday night. If that isn't a three-hour radio program packed with information, all different kinds, I don't know what is, and I always learn. I feel very blessed to be able to do this. Hope you feel the same about learning, and have a good weekend, and do put away some food if you have a chance. Take care. Talk soon.